slaughter of women and children. In retaliation, the offended tribe had launched a string of attacks along one of the main supply routes. Their Warsaw Pact patrons were perplexed and angry. This distraction, they said, did nothing to advance the war against U.S. interests. Relations between his group and the East Germans, in particular, were tense because of these tribal conflicts. Having been educated in the West, my agent understood Jeffersonian democracy, and he doubted he would ever see such progress in his country in his lifetime. He was right. But he and I understood there was no substitute for progress, even if only slight and incremental. There was also no substitute for our hopeful collaboration. I ran him for almost 3 years. I turned him over to another officer. A couple of years later, yet another officer was handling him. He served the CIA loyally. He produced hundreds of reports. He earned a good salary, but his true reward was seeking to help his people. He wanted for his people a viable and secure nation with what he believed was a necessary and close relationship with the United States. He understood the concept of liberal institutions, free markets, and democracy. He aspired to help transplant those ideas and ideals to his patch of Africa. He never realized his dream. Returning from a CIA mission, he died at a desolate, dusty border crossing. The CIA did not learn of his death for several days. On another mission, in another part of the world, I would not learn of his tragic end for several weeks. To the world, of course, this hero agent is unknown, and within the CIA long forgotten, except for a couple of other case officers and me. That is the nature of espionage. Today, if he were alive, I would invite him to my home. I would introduce him to my wife and sons who were raised in Africa. We would discuss the wonders of the bush. We would talk about politics. We would sit on the deck under the oak trees. I would grill steaks and enjoy watching him eat. He always ate with relish and gusto, just as he lived his life. He was more than a happy spy. He was more than one of my best agents. He was my teacher. He was a brilliant, strong, and courageous man who loved and served his people. He was a friend and an inspiration. He represented a hope for Africa. I miss him. Compromise. He borrowed the money from the embassy's petty cash fund, ostensibly to buy supplies. He lost it in a single foolish act. He had no means to replenish the stolen money. It was not that much, but more than he had, more than he could get. He knew the embassy would audit the cash next week, if not sooner. This was more than just a minor theft. It was a breach of security, a risk to his employer, his government. His supervisor lived for vindictive opportunities, especially if he was also placed at risk, and to a degree he would also be accountable. His boss and everybody in the embassy would have no mercy. They would wonder what other crimes he had committed. If he was guilty of this, they would suspect he was compromised in other ways. They were like a nest of snakes, all coiled and ready to strike at any danger, even from within. They all lived in unspoken, merciless fear. If caught, he faced a grueling and brutal investigation, followed by a long prison sentence. This was because of his position, because of his unique professional responsibility. He was a communications officer, also known as a code clerk, in an embassy. He was not an average code clerk. He worked for his country's Foreign Intelligence Service. He held the keys, the cryptographic keys, to his service's communications system. He also had access to the files. He knew almost everything about his country's espionage networks in the country. His service could not tolerate any breach of discipline, any criminal act, no matter how petty. He had a wife and children, whom he had also placed in danger. The children were back home with his wife's parents. They served as de facto hostages against his defection. Unless he found an answer, they would all suffer retribution and the stigma of political unreliability. Such a stupid act, on a stupid whim, he thought. Like almost every official from his country posted abroad, he had considered defection. The lure of the West was obvious. The images and the notions of freedom, money, cars, movies, big houses, and opportunities seeped through the censors. And when abroad, even in third world countries, the temptations of defection sparkled even brighter. But he could not. He loved his family, and he could not abandon them. In fact, he must protect them. It was his Christian duty. He lived such a contradiction. He drank heavily, often, gambled some, and consorted with prostitutes when he could. These vices were not so bad, he thought. Perhaps he would sin more, but his service constrained his movements, limited his free time, and monitored his actions. Nevertheless, he considered himself a good man, a good husband and father. He was brilliant, he knew, but he acted stupidly. He loved his country, but he was apolitical. Yet he lived in a society and worked for a service defined by politics. His society rejected God, but he knew there was a God. His maternal grandmother had taught him about the Bible, faith, and redemption. He hid his Christian beliefs. He prayed secretly. He prayed now for an answer to his dilemma. On Saturday mornings, he visited the local market with his family and others from the embassy. That was tomorrow. He studied the map of the area. Earlier, he had memorized the residential addresses of all the CIA officers in the city. His service kept track of these enemy officers for counterintelligence reasons. His memory was superb, so he could recall each address. He visualized them on the map in front of him. One of the CIA's main objectives in the country was to penetrate his embassy, his intelligence service. He understood his potential value to the CIA. He found what he wanted, an officer's address within 10 minutes' walk from the market, 20 minutes round trip, less if he walked quickly. Even that was a long time to be away from the market, but he had no other option. The CIA officer, according to his recollection of the file, was young. This was only his second tour. There was no assessment of the officer. Was he sufficiently mature? Was he competent? His service had a penetration of the host country's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, who provided the information on all official U.S. personnel. Among them, his service had tagged the CIA officers. He did not know how they determined the identities of the CIA personnel, but they seemed to know them all. He had memorized the officer's photograph and other details, including the make, model, color, and license number of the officer's car. Early the next morning, he wrote a detailed note in English. The note included a simple but exact map. It had taken him 2 hours, because he constantly referred to a dictionary. His English was rudimentary, so he had to guard against any mistakes. He had considered writing the note in his native language, but did not think the CIA had a locally based officer who knew his mother tongue. And he feared that the CIA could not relay the note to translators elsewhere, get a response, and act in time. He had waited until the last possible moment to write because he did not want incriminating evidence in his possession any longer than necessary. He used water-soluble paper so he could destroy it in seconds. If necessary, he would eat it. He repeatedly creased the paper in precise geometrical lines. Then he folded it tightly, perfectly. At the market, he slipped away from his wife and others and walked briskly to the CIA officer's address. Less than 10 minutes. He spotted the car parked in the driveway only a few feet from the curb. Thank God, he thought. He saw only a couple of people on the quiet residential street. It was still early. He walked to the driver's side door and shoved the note into the crack between the door and the frame. 5 seconds. He was back on the street. He had rejected placing the note under the windshield wiper as too obvious. Any attempt to knock on the door of the house and meet the officer was problematic. That would be complicated, time-consuming, and dangerous. The note was his best option, although a long shot. The car was there, so at least he had a chance. He returned to the market, purchased flowers for his wife, and wandered back into the slow stream of shoppers. The next evening he asked permission to visit the kiosk 2 blocks from his embassy. He needed cigarettes for himself and chocolate for his wife. The security officer concurred, then offered to join him. Damn.